With so many media platforms out there, information is not in short supply. Neither is misinformation.
We saw a lot of conspiracy theories and hoaxes about the source of the virus. So this is misinformation about the, you know, the virus being created in the lab or being created as a bioweapon.
I'm Shamitha Basu, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, May 12th, how the noise is overwhelming the signal. Plus, maternity wards are disappearing in predominantly Black neighborhoods across the country.
You cannot ignore race. You cannot ignore gender, socioeconomic status. You cannot ignore the type of community someone lives in when you give them care.
We're going to talk about it. And we round out the show by chatting with some old friends. The Takeaway's former movie date hosts give us some good suggestions for what we can watch during this stressful time. Do you have suggestions yourself? 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. Let's get to it. Last week, a coronavirus conspiracy video called Plandemic was released online. It's filled with inaccurate information and advice that goes against just about everything medical experts have told the public about COVID-19. In the nearly 30-minute video, Judy Mikovits, a discredited research scientist, espouses a number of conspiracy theories against Dr. Anthony Fauci, multiple public health agencies, vaccines, and she refutes the benefits of masks, of washing your hands, and of social distancing.
Why would you close the beach? You've got sequences in the soil, in the sand. You've got healing microbes in the ocean, in the salt water. That's insanity.
That's a clip from Plandemic, in which Mikovits tells viewers that beaches should have remained open during the pandemic for unscientific reasons that experts say have no basis in fact. Science Magazine actually did a big fact check on Mikovits recently, and we have that linked on our website for you to check out yourself. Still, the video apparently struck a chord with many Americans, and within days it had been watched tens of millions of times, and Mikovits' book became a bestseller on Amazon. YouTube and Facebook have taken the video down because of its falsehoods, but its massive spread came at a moment when getting clear, accurate health information to the public was crucial, and the spread of misinformation at a time like this can be costly. We've got two people on the line to discuss the spread of misinformation around COVID-19 and why it matters. Emily Vraga is an associate professor in the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for being here, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
And Daniel Funke, a staff writer covering online misinformation for PolitiFact. It's good to have you here too, Daniel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Emily, how do you and your colleagues define misinformation?
So, misinformation is probably best categorized as information that is considered accurate based on the best available evidence from relevant experts at the time.
Mm-hmm. And Daniel, I know that you've been tracking COVID-related misinformation for PolitiFact. What trends have you noticed emerging at different points in this pandemic?
Yeah, so early on in the pandemic, in January, February, we saw a lot of conspiracy theories and hoaxes about the source of the virus. So this is misinformation about the, you know, the virus being created in the lab or being created as a bioweapon. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it kind of evolved into misinformation about cures and treatments for the virus as people started to take it seriously. And now we're seeing the rise of political misinformation about the virus. So trying to peg it to a certain political party or trying to link financial connections to certain politicians.
And how do you identify what is misinformation? Like, how do you decide which misinformation is actually worth fact-checking?
Yeah, so every single day I scroll through hundreds of social media posts and try to decide which ones I want to cover. And we look at a couple of different things. So first, we want to see if there is a fact-checkable claim. So we see a lot of social media posts that are salacious or hyperpartisan, but we're always looking to see if we can judge it based on some preconceived set of evidence, whether it's data or just other evidence that we can find online. And then secondly, we want to make sure that that post has reached enough people that it is worth covering, because at PolitiFact, we don't want to reintroduce people to misinformation that they might not have seen before. So we look at things like how many times a post has been shared or liked or commented on. And there's no right answer here or number that we use to justify our fact check, but we use those as signals to determine whether or not we pursue something. And then finally, we always want to make sure that our readers are asking us about it. So at PolitiFact, we have really engaged readers who will send us DMs or emails asking us to look into certain social media posts or claims. And we assume that if we've received one email from a reader about a certain piece of content, there are probably dozens of other readers who had the same question but didn't reach out to us.
And are there specific characteristics that you tend to find in misinformation that goes viral?
Yeah, so the most viral misinformation often taps into something that the broad population is wondering about, right? So with Plandemic, it is a polished version of the conspiracy theories that we see every single day online. It answers some of the biggest questions that people have right now about the coronavirus pandemic. One of the frustrating things about misinformation, especially during a pandemic, is that oftentimes the answer is we don't know, or researchers are still looking into this, or there's no evidence to back this up. And that's most of the falsehoods that are made in Plandemic. So this kind of misinformation is really appealing to people that want answers about something that is really complicated, like a infectious disease that has recently emerged. But that stuff is often false or unsupported, and it goes viral really quickly on social media.
Emily, I'm thinking about past public health crises. Does the misinformation that's being shared right now about COVID-19 look similar or follow any similar trends to misinformation that was shared in the past?
Yes. And I think Daniel explained exactly why that would be. People are looking for answers that science just can't necessarily give us. I also think people are looking for solutions that science can't necessarily give us yet, or that are really hard. No one particularly likes social distancing. And the difficulties created by that, it would be much easier to believe that, you know, simply putting pepper in your food or gargling water or any of these other kind of false cures that we see online are effective than I have to, you know, distance myself from all my loved ones. So I think that the characteristics that make us want to believe misinformation are really similar across different kind of diseases. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities between the kinds of misinformation we're seeing now versus what we saw earlier.
And Emily, is there any way of measuring COVID-19 misinformation and the spread of misinformation with real life health consequences?
I think that that's an especially important characteristic to think about is a lot of misinformation doesn't have necessarily any consequence. So I mentioned the WHO has debunked this idea that putting hot pepper in your food is going to prevent or cure COVID. Now, if I believe that and I don't take appropriate precautions, then it does have really problematic consequences. If I'm still washing my hands and social distancing, a little extra pepper in my food is probably not going to affect me one way or the other. So I think separating out those kinds of misinformation that have consequences versus those that are perhaps a little less consequential is important to do. That being said, of course, the things we think affect the things we do. And so if you believe something that's untrue, you might act in ways that are not ideal.
Daniel, what responsibility do social media companies have to stop the spread of misinformation on their platforms? And what are they actually doing so far?
Yeah, so for a long time, social media companies like Facebook have kind of abdicated some responsibility when it comes to misinformation, right? Saying that they don't want to be an arbiter of truth and they don't want to remove false content, but would rather leave it up to the community to decide. With the pandemic, we have seen a lot of social media companies take a harder line when it comes to misinformation. The reason why is because a lot of health misinformation can have direct or dire consequences. So take, for example, the false claim that drinking bleach cures the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. This is a really dangerous claim that could lead to hospitalizations and even death in some cases. So we saw Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube take down claims that actually relate to this, because they go against their community guidelines, wanting to avoid harmful misinformation. So we have seen some of the tech companies take hard lines when it comes to misinformation that could directly cause a harm like that. Now, when you get to a gray area is when you get to political misinformation, right? So Facebook doesn't really want to touch false claims made by politicians. And that's an interesting policy choice, but it does show that there are still gaps in their policies.
Emily, I'm thinking about just the rest of us who are on these social media platforms. And when we see others sharing misinformation, what's the best way for us to respond? And I'm thinking of this happening in two ways. There's the posts that you see by people that you don't really know well, that you, I don't know, went to high school with and you're not really in touch with. And then there's the people who are posting who you're actually close to or that who you're related to. What's the right way to respond?
So I've been doing research on this topic with Dr. Letitia Bodhi from Georgetown University for a number of years. And the answer is respond. There's a lot of evidence that when you correct somebody on social media, you can do a benefit for the entire community seeing that interaction. So the person sharing the misinformation might be the hardest one to reach. They're the ones who were convinced enough of something that they're willing to share it. But everyone else, they're a step removed and might be more easily corrected. The other thing to point out is this is actually happening quite often. So we did a survey at the end of March, and we found that about a third of Americans said they had seen someone else being corrected on social media in the past week related to COVID-19. And even more importantly, people tended to like that kind of behavior. They said it was part of the public's responsibility, or that, you know, explicitly that they like it when people are correcting others. So it's not something that people tend to, it might not always be comfortable, but it is something people tend to appreciate.
But what happens when the social media users are put in the position of being the editors of what's on those platforms? I mean, it, not only can it be exhausting for some people to constantly be trying to correct misinformation, is that really the most effective way for people to be on these platforms with each other?
It certainly can be exhausting. And I'm not saying you have to fact check every single claim you see, but if you see somebody sharing something you know to be false, the best thing you can do is reply with the accurate information and provide a link to some kind of expert source. And that could be the CDC, that could be your local health company, it could be a news media organization that you trust. So making sure people have that accurate information. And again, it's not necessarily about the person sharing the misinformation. We want to update them. We want to make sure they have the correct information. That can actually become a difficult sell. Mm-hmm. But it's about everyone else who sees that post. You don't want them left with an inaccurate impression of what the evidence is right now. And so finding ways to do that when you see misinformation, correcting it, makes social media a better place for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Emily, what do you think is the responsibility of the social media companies in these cases to combat misinformation? Daniel talked a little bit about what kinds of actions have been taken by, so far by Twitter or by Facebook, but do we know what's actually effective?
So we know that some of these types of steps can be affected. So Facebook's related stories algorithm, where they show fact checks after you share misinformation, has been shown to reduce misperceptions among people seeing those misinformation stories. Other steps they can take is trying to, again, make it more difficult to see that misinformation, making it clear that there is more accurate information so that when you give people something that's misinformation, but you also give them something that's accurate, most people are going to take that accurate information instead. But it's making sure that they have that accurate information there at that exact same point in time.
Daniel, PolitiFact has found a number of statements that President Trump has made about COVID-19 to be false or mostly false. What's the best way to combat misinformation when it comes directly from the president?
Yeah, so this was a tough one, right? Because President Trump, as opposed to some social media users, has arguably the biggest pulpit in the world by which he can make claims. At PolitiFact, we take the approach that it is best to just call him out every time there is a falsehood being uttered on national television. So we will retweet or tweet our fact checks over and over again. Some people say that this isn't enough to correct the president. But fact checkers like PolitiFact believe that we just want to put as much credible information in front of people as possible. Our goal isn't necessarily to get the president to change his mind, right? But we want the American people to know, hey, the president is saying this during the coronavirus press briefings, and it's not actually true, or it's half true, or here's some context you need. So that's something we're doing, and I think a lot of journalists could do that. And if you're someone watching the president during a coronavirus press briefing and you hear something interesting, or you go, hey, is that true? Just do a quick Google search. Oftentimes that'll turn up plenty of press coverage that contextualizes what you're seeing.
And Emily, aside from trying to correct bad information that people see on social media, on their friends' posts, what can people do to avoid sharing or amplifying misinformation? What should they be looking for?
I think what Daniel said is actually the best thing that you can do is don't try necessarily to just look at a piece of information and decide within the context of that article, is this true or not? Plandemic looks very professionally done. You have somebody who has the title of doctor, but as soon as you do some searching, you'll see all of the problems with that content. There are fake news websites that try to look like real news websites that mimic the things that we look for, but Googling or looking for their names elsewhere can give you really important cues about whether or not that source can be trusted. So taking that extra 30 seconds to search and look for that information that seems too good to be true or just seems outlandish can really help you discover whether other people have already kind of debunked that information and prevent you from sharing something that's false.
Mm. Emily, you know, I'm sort of struggling with some of my family members, older family members who may not be very tech savvy, who don't spend a lot of time necessarily on the internet, and who have sometimes been sending me some things that are full of misinformation, especially at a moment like this. How do I advise my family members on how to navigate information at a time like this?
That's really hard. You're not just asking them to think carefully about the information they're seeing, but learn a whole new set of skills. The idea of opening a new tab and searching for something is second nature for a lot of people, but for others, they might not know what exactly that means. So I think that understanding where people are and showing a lot of empathy is a really important first step. And then back to trying to get them to search for things. There's a lot of fantastic fact-checking happening. A lot of people are doing their best to make sure the high-quality information is available. It just involves us taking that time to go an extra step and not just retweet something that seems totally true to us. It matches what we feel in our gut, but actually matches reality.
Emily Vraga is an associate professor at the University of Minnesota, and Daniel Funke is a staff writer covering online misinformation for PolitiFact. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
As college and university campuses around the country remain closed due to COVID-19, Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos released new rules this month around campus sexual assault. These new rules establish a more narrow definition of sexual harassment and require schools to allow direct cross-examination of victims. Many advocacy organizations are unsurprisingly concerned about the impact this will have on survivors coming forward. They say these new rules allow schools to use a standard of evidence that might favor those accused of sexual harassment or assault. I spoke about this with Sage Carson, a sexual assault survivor and a manager at Know Your Nine, a project for empowering students to end gender violence in schools. And I spoke to Anna North, a senior reporter at Vox, where she covers gender issues. The new rules define sexual harassment as unwelcome conduct that is so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that it denies a person access to the school's education program or activity. I first asked Anna how that definition will change things for students.
So what a lot of folks say that would mean is that really a student would have to feel that they're forced out of something in their education in order to really have a case under Title IX. They would have to feel that they couldn't go to class because they were being forced to go to class with their rapist, or they could no longer stay in their dorm because someone that had assaulted them lived there. They'd have to say that their education had been severely and pervasively impacted in this way.
So if a high school student goes to their principal or goes to their Title IX coordinator and says, I'm experiencing harassment, the school could say it's not bad enough and turn them away. That's extremely concerning because we know that many folks, when they seek out for help the first time and they're turned away, will never seek out help again.
And the new rules also change the standards for evidence. Can you explain what's different now?
So under the Obama era guidelines, the schools were required to use a standard called the preponderance of the evidence standard when adjudicating sexual harassment and assault cases. And that standard basically means that the accused person would be found responsible if the evidence showed it was more likely than not that the violation occurred. Now, under the new guidelines, schools may use that standard, but they may also use a standard called clear and convincing evidence. That standard is generally seen to be more favorable to the accused student.
Also, it says that it has to effectively deny someone access to education. So that would mean that someone would have to drop out of class or school entirely before a school can take action. The purpose of Title IX is that students are able to continue their education even if they experience gender violence. It's meant to be preventative. What this rule would require is for students' educations to already be detrimentally impacted before a school ever takes action.
You experienced sexual assault during college, and you've said that if these new rules had been in place at that time, your case would have been handled very differently.
I experienced sexual assault my sophomore year of college. I was assaulted at an off-campus apartment after attending an off-campus party. I had been fed drinks by my abuser, who was very aware that the more and more intoxicated I was, the more likely it would be that they'd be able to assault me. I was taken to an off-campus apartment and was assaulted there. Following my assault, I was really unable to succeed in school. I was in a really, really small department at my school, and so was my rapist. So that meant that anytime I walked into the single building that all of our classes were in, I was forced to see him. So I really stopped attending classes. I stopped participating in activities related to my education and stopped really leaving my apartment at all. My scholarship that allowed me to attend school as a low-income student was also tied to my participation in that department. So while my grades were falling, I was unable to transfer because I couldn't get funding to go to another school with how low my grades had dropped, and I really saw no other options besides dropping out of school. I was lucky enough to be in contact with a campus advocate who helped me file a formal report and helped me seek support from my institution. I should say that DeVos's current rules allow schools and actually require schools to dismiss cases of sexual violence that occur outside of a university program or activity.
So off-campus housing as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So what this means is that schools would be required to dismiss cases of sexual assault that happen at off-campus parties, off-campus housing, and also outside of the U.S. So that means violence that happens in study abroad programs or possibly international travel that schools would go on together. This also does include unmarked fraternity houses. So while the department says that they are not allowing fraternities to be excluded from this provision, actually, if a school doesn't recognize the fraternity or doesn't recognize the fraternity house, they could never be punished by the school for committing sexual violence in them. Mm.
One of the new rules requires schools to hold live hearings where direct cross-examination would be allowed. And Sage, you actually did face cross-examination when you accused your assaulter. I mean, what did that mean for you?
Yeah, when I was a student and I reported my assault to my school, I was told 2 days before our hearing that I was going to be going through cross-examination by my rapist. And because of that, I dropped my case. I've gotten a lot of pushback when I've talked about that by folks that have said, well, if you were telling the truth, why would you be scared to be questioned about it in the first place? And I was not scared of the questions that would be asked, more that the only thing that I could really remember about the assault, what my rapist said the entire time. And I was terrified to hear their voice again. Mm. It gave me nightmares, it gave me panic attacks, and stopped me from going to class because I was scared to simply hear their voice. And so I dropped my case because I would rather have, you know, not move forward with it at all than had to go through that process. And I've talked to many other survivors who feel the same way. Cross-examination can happen through neutral third parties, where both parties pose questions to a neutral third party. They decide what questions are appropriate and then ask them to both parties. What DeVos's rule requires, that many courts don't require of due process in school, is that both parties question each other through the representative. And DeVos's rule does not put any limitations on who can be the representative for each party besides that either cannot represent themselves. This means that a survivor could be questioned by their rapist parent, fraternity brother, friend, or new partner, which could be an extremely traumatizing process and also leads itself open to being very harassing in nature. I've talked to many survivors who, when they named their rapist and reported to their school, their rapist collected statements from their fraternity brothers about how they were a great man and they would never have done this. DeVos's new rule would now allow rapists to bring their friends into examination to question survivors and their witnesses as well.
Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos has said in a statement, too many students have lost access to their education because their school inadequately responded when a student filed a complaint of sexual harassment or sexual assault. Anna, has DeVos been pushed on that claim? Do we know how many students in the United States have been expelled or banned from their universities or colleges due to a sexual harassment disciplinary process?
So something I found really interesting about that statement is that it's actually not clear that it applies only to accused students. If you look at it, she's saying that they have lost access to their education because their school inadequately responded when a student filed a complaint. Now, the point of Title IX is to prevent people from losing access to their education because of harassment. So she may be trying to thread the needle and in that statement say, you know, that students may have lost access to their education because they reported harassment or assault, but their school mishandled that claim. And certainly we have heard from many survivors who say exactly that.
This is Sage. I just wanted to add that one study found that about a third of survivors drop out of school after experiencing sexual violence. So we do know that a large majority of survivors leave school because of the violence that they experience. While there isn't nationwide data on how many students have been punished because of sexual misconduct accusations, a good place that I always look is the University of Michigan, who publishes the outcomes of their reports and investigations every year. And one of their reports showed that there were over 200 reports to the school of sexual violence. And of that, only one student was expelled for sexual violence.
Many college and university campuses are closed right now due to the pandemic, and this rule has sort of quietly been enacted. Does school or campus closures have anything to do with that? Is there anything to this timing, do you think, Sage?
Yeah, I think that the department itself showed what it thinks of its own rule by releasing it during a global pandemic when schools are in crisis. These rules were proposed 2 years ago. They were originally supposed to come out last fall, and they are now chosen to be released in the middle of a pandemic. I would say that Know Your Nine sent a letter to over 500 university administrators and Title IX coordinators because we heard from survivors across the country that their Title IX coordinators were either not responding to their questions about what school closures would mean for their case or for the academic accommodations that they were receiving under Title IX, mm-hmm. that their Title IX coordinators were ignoring them or delaying their cases indefinitely until they returned to school. And so Know Your Nine sent out resources for schools to know how to better respond to sexual misconduct during remote learning and how they could continue carrying out cases. Schools have been begging for months for further guidance on how they should be handling school closures, how they should be supporting students right now, and how they should be handling Title IX. But DeVos has largely failed to respond to them and provide them the resources that they need to do right by students right now, and instead is prioritizing rolling back the rights of student survivors instead of providing them protections that they need right now to continue their education.
Sage Carson is a sexual assault survivor and a manager at Know Your Nine, and Anna North is a senior reporter at Vox. Thank you both very much.
Thanks so much.
In some cities across the country, maternity wards are disappearing in Black neighborhoods. Experts call these areas maternity care deserts.
Those are areas where women have limited access to maternity care services, such as prenatal care or maternity wards, or they have none at all.
Now, many are worried that as the coronavirus pandemic continues, these deserts could become a truly nationwide trend. Kelly Glass recently wrote about this for the New York Times. She's a freelance journalist who reports on the intersections of parenting, health, and race. Here's what Kelly told me about why hospitals are closing their maternity wards.
It's something that we saw with rural hospitals. I think one thing that we have to remember is that hospitals are businesses, and I think we don't talk about that enough, but the fact of the matter is they want to make a profit. Maternity wards tend to not be as profitable as other areas of hospitals, so when things need to get cut, those are often on the chopping block first.
You mentioned rural areas being a place where this happens a lot, but I understand also from your reporting and others that maternity wards in Black communities are often among the first things to go when slashing hospital budgets. Why is that happening?
We have the data on rural hospitals because that's what has been previously looked at. But maternity wards and even hospitals closing in Black neighborhoods has been something that's sort of, I guess, quietly under the scene been going on for a while. So in the case of Chicago in particular, we saw 3 maternity wards close within the last year. And again, hospitals are businesses. So we're talking money. We're talking prioritizing who gets care, unfortunately. So in this case, when St. Bernard's closed, they announced the closure as out of necessity to accommodate COVID-19 patients. So decisions were made, people were moved, and the people who ended up being displaced, you know, they're often Black people in Black neighborhoods.
And are we seeing that happen a lot right now? Is COVID-19 playing a role in the shuttering of these types of wards?
The data we have on that is like, it's really not there. Nobody is keeping very good track of this at all. But we saw this in Washington, D.C., where several hospitals and maternity wards closed. We saw it in Philadelphia, where, again, several hospitals and maternity wards closed. So we know what's happening. We know what's been happening in cities. And we know that the coronavirus pandemic stands to worsen it. Because if there is a need for space in cities, you know, decisions are going to be made. I guess the major concern there is that we become aware of it sooner rather than later, so that we stop it and mitigate it before it has devastating effects on, you know, the Black community.
What do we know about how this is affecting health outcomes for Black mothers in these so-called deserts?
We know that the maternal mortality rate in this country is tragic. It's the highest of any developed nation. So we have that going on. We know that Black women basically bear the brunt of that high maternal mortality rate. And we know that when Black women do not have a few things going on, so we need continuity of care. They need to have ongoing relationships with the care team that they know is going to take care of them. They need to have a care team that is culturally competent. So in community hospitals such as St. Bernard Hospital in Chicago, which I discuss in this piece, they basically reimagine healthcare to fit the needs of their population. And we do know from research that social determinants are very important. You cannot ignore race. You cannot ignore gender, socioeconomic status. You cannot ignore the type of community someone lives in when you give them care. So considering that we cannot do this, you know, I treat everybody the same approach to healthcare that I think has been prevalent. Black birthing people, they need more of a community-based approach than that. And when they don't get that, unfortunately, we see deaths go up. We see morbidity and injury and birth trauma go up for that population.
I have some numbers here in front of me. I just want to read them for you and also ask you to sort of respond to them and talk about how your reporting has also supported these. But according to the Centers for Disease Control, Black women in the United States are 3 to 4 times more likely to die of mm-hmm. pregnancy-related complications than white women. And even in studies that compared Black women and white women who had the same common medical complications around pregnancy, Black women were still more likely to die than their white counterparts. And this disparity, I know I'm based in New York. It's even higher in New York City.
Yeah.
What are some of the reasons for these disparate maternal health outcomes?
There's very real implicit bias that's going on at the hospital level. Unfortunately, that factors into how these women are getting care. Black women simply do not feel listened to by their doctors. And when that happens, a lot of things get overlooked. A lot of these deaths are preventable, and a lot of them probably could be prevented if Black women felt listened to, if they were listened to by the care team at the hospital. You have that going on. You also have this more physiological thing going on where we know that the chronic stress of racism has dire effects on a woman's body. So you have Black women who are carrying this chronic stress in our wombs, basically. It makes pregnancy more complicated oftentimes. If we're really, really honest about it, racism is at the root of this.
When you talk about Black women not feeling listened to by their doctors, I'm assuming there you mean by their doctors who are not of the same race.
Correct.
So what do we know about what's happening in hospitals where there are more providers of color, or at the very least, ones who are more culturally competent? What happens in those cases? What happens especially for Black mothers?
There was a piece in the journal Pediatrics recently showed that Black NICU babies received better care in what would be considered a poor quality NICU or hospital. And they were considered poor quality because those hospitals are in majority Black neighborhoods. So we know that Black women and Black babies have better outcomes when they have Black doctors.
Are there any ways in which this particular crisis, the pandemic that we are all experiencing, can affect maternal health outcomes for Black women in particular?
I think our healthcare system was already overwhelmed, already had its structural faults, but I do think that the coronavirus pandemic has highlighted and maybe even exaggerated some of those faults. And when you have a system that is overwhelmed, decisions are made. People are prioritized and people are under prioritized. And often that means Black women, that means Black people in general. It's safe to say that if there is not some active awareness about this being a possibility and some solutions in place to make sure that we have an equitable approach to fixing these faults, that we could stand to see this maternal mortality rate, especially among Black women, rise. What I do hope comes out of this is that we finally realize that we don't need to wait until a public health crisis becomes a public health crisis to start taking action, that the sooner the better.
So it sounds like you're saying that there is data to support that having doctors who are Black, nurses who are Black, providers who are Black, actually makes a big difference on the health outcomes of a Black mother and her child. What are some other ways to mitigate the maternal health disparities, both in the short term and in the long term?
There are a lot of things that need to happen. It's hard to find a one-size-fits-all approach, but there are some things. For example, we tend to have a I care for everyone the same attitude in healthcare, and we don't need to do that. What we need to do is we need to care for everyone based on their needs, based on their social determinants of health, and that education needs to happen at the medical school level. So when they're teaching doctors, make that a real part of the curriculum, make sure that they are learning those things, learning about the different populations they might work with, learning about what their different needs are. If they have something else going on at home, that it is a part of their OB care to talk to their doctor about it, and it makes a big difference. I mean, imagine simple things like not having transportation to your appointment. Mm-hmm. Now, at my OB's office, if I cancel an appointment, there's not a consideration that maybe I just didn't have a way to get there and have a hospital staff or a clinic staff call me up and say, hey, can I help you arrange transportation? Reimagining healthcare altogether to make sure that we're not ignoring these very, very important social determinants of health, I think is going to be key. I mean, of course, we cannot erase racism, but we can mitigate its effects with those things. And I think we need to start thinking that way.
And how might doulas or midwives help to fill in the gaps here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think doulas and midwives are a huge part of the solution. I think that one of the barriers with that is, again, policy. For example, in Illinois, in the state I'm in, there are about 10 certified nurse midwives in the entire state, and CPM certified professional midwives, which is a different kind of credential, are not recognized at all. We do not allow doulas to be paid with Medicaid, as most states do. I think right now only 2 states allow doulas to be paid with Medicaid. So mm-hmm. we have those as real options if only they were more accessible. And we need the policy to make them more accessible. What I hope comes out of this is that we again say, you know, options for birthing people are important. So not just hospital births, but yes, home births are a real option. Doula attended births, midwife attended births in hospitals, in birthing centers. So more options, but also more access, obviously, to make those options real.
Kelly Glass is a freelance journalist who reports on the intersections of parenting, health, and race. Kelly, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
Have you ever seen a commie drink a glass of water?
What?
Why do you want a little bit? Because if you're going to drink, I'd rather you do it in the house.
Why do you think I'm calling you? Just to say hello?
Did you see the memo about this?
And you won't be angry?
I will not be angry.
This is healthy. This is good.
That's the intro music that used to accompany these fine folks.
2011, 1966, and 1914. Which of these years, if you had to choose, which of these years would you go back to?
Oh, man. Not 1914. That everyone's about to die.
Doesn't sound that great, does it?
The Great War, they didn't use the word great correctly in that one. It was not great.
That, of course, is Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and longtime contributor to The Takeaway, and Kristen Meinzer, a culture critic and the author of How to Be Fine. If these voices sound familiar, it's because Rafer and Kristen hosted the Takeaway Movie Date podcast, which ended back in early 2016. But since then, they told us longtime fans have been getting back in touch and asking for recommendations on what to watch in the era of COVID-19. So Rafer and Kristen have reunited to create a new podcast called Movie Therapy. And we're so excited to have them back here on The Takeaway to talk about their movie prescriptions for this moment. Welcome back to the show, Kristen and Rafer.
Hi, Shamita. We're so excited to be back.
Excited to have you. Well, Kristen, it sounds like you definitely got a nudge from old fans, but why did you two want to get back together again to talk about movies at this time?
Oh, well, Rafer and I have always enjoyed going to movies together and talking about movies. And I think we always thought it'd be great if at some point we could work together again. But then, you know, old listeners reached out and kind of asked us to. So that gave us the nudge to do it. And we understand why. They are at home more than ever. And a lot of people are needing some comfort. A lot of people are watching more TV than they ever have in their lives. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily know what to watch. And in some cases, people really just want a movie or a TV show that's going to speak to their particular feelings, whether those feelings are, I want to kill my husband, he's driving me nuts, or I need a vacation from my kids, or I need a good cry, whatever it is.
Rafer, how do you think movies can be therapeutic at a time like this?
Well, I think movies, first and foremost, you know, whether you want to admit it or not, they really are just an escape. You know, when I was a kid and I fell in love with movies, it was because they were a real escape. You could go into this fantasy world and you could kind of maybe see your best self on screen. You could sort of see the world as you'd like it to be, the way you wanted it to be. So there's a lot of escapist elements to that. I know, you know, film critics and film snobs will talk about how movies are supposed to reflect reality and you want to see deep things with a lot of nuance and things that are believable and convincing and, you know, show the world and acknowledge realism. But I think when you really get down to it, they're wish fulfillment and they're fantasies and they're dreams. And so I think they can be pretty helpful at a time like this.
Kristen, what are some of the most common things that people have been writing to you about and asking for you to sort of solve for them with movie suggestions?
Oh, well, I already mentioned a few of them. You know, some folks are really feeling a little bit tense with the other people under their roof right now. Mm-hmm. Some people are feeling quite anxious. But also we have people who very commonly write to us saying they're addicted to reading the news. They stay up late just scrolling through their phones. Mm. And we've been hearing a lot just in the last few days from people who have canceled summer plans and are worried about that and are thinking about what they can do to replace that.
Yeah, so tell us what your recommendations are for those people who are in news overload land. Rafer, do you want to describe what you're telling people to watch?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think what you want at a time like this, like I said, is something that would kind of get you out of this bubble and get you to a happier place. You know, it's mm-hmm. funny, there are a lot of movies that come out over the years where that are kind of sort of trivial and insubstantial, where not much happens. And I always sniff at those movies back in the day, although now during the pandemic, they seem a lot better to me in hindsight. And one of the ones that I might recommend is a little movie by Jon Favreau called Chef, which came out in 2014, made a little bit of a splash, but wasn't a big hit. You know, he's the guy that did the Iron Man movie and the first Iron Man. He did the recent Lion King.
Yeah.
Usually a big budget director. You know, he usually works with a lot of money, but he did this little small personal film in 2014 where he plays a chef who has a meltdown on social media, becomes the laughingstock of the foodie world. He's unemployable. Starts out at the bottom, has to drive a food truck, drives it with his son, and of course it does so well that they drive it across the country and everything ends terrific. And it's one of these movies that has no plot, no conflict, no villain of any kind, but it's got a great cast, Scarlett Johansson and John Leguizamo and Amy Sedaris, small role for Robert Downey Jr., he's in it, and it's just one of those forget your troubles movies. It's the kind of thing that would have been like a blockbuster during the Great Depression or something, and you know, like I say, I didn't lavish it with praise at the time, but you know, in the middle of a pandemic, I think it might be the thing to watch.
You know, in my household, we literally put on a kids' film the other day, and it's just me and my husband here. We watched the animated film Rio. We were just feeling overloaded.
Yes.
We needed to see some dancing and singing parrots, and it was just perfect, yeah. Sort of. Now, Kristen, we have about a minute or two left. You talked about people who might be missing their summer plans or maybe travel plans. What are your prescriptions for that?
Yeah, well, one of my most basic prescriptions is always, if you're going to go on a trip, watch a movie that will get you in the mood for that. So even if you can't go on that road trip, maybe watch a movie like National Lampoon's Vacation so you can get that road trip feeling. Maybe watch a movie that takes place once in each stop along the way. If your kids were going to be going to some sort of day camp this summer, maybe you can do something like watch adventure movies together that kind of give them that sense of excitement of going off into the world, like Troop Zero that is on Netflix right now, or, you know, different kinds of movies that capture their imagination as kids, like Back to the Future, something that you can vote together as a family on, let's watch this movie tonight, or have the kids pick out the movies, and then next week you can pick out the movies as grown-ups and you can take turns. Mm-hmm. And one other thing, you don't have to stop having adventures just because you're at home. You can try maybe creating a drive-in movie experience in your backyard or on your front driveway by projecting movies there. And then you can still feel like you're going on maybe a little vacation just by watching a movie outside.
Nice. We have just a little bit of time left, so I'm going to try and squeeze this in. Do you have any recommendations for people who are actually wanting to lean into the dystopia of our current reality?
Oh, so many. Yes. Rafer and I disagree on this, but I think a lot of people enjoy leaning in.
Yeah,
he's not
sure.
One to lean in.
But, well, Kristen, what are your favorites?
I think it's great to watch a show like Grey's Anatomy, something that's kind of a procedural where there's an answer at the end of the episode. There's disaster happening everywhere. Things are beeping. People are on gurneys. But at the end of the episode, you always get an answer. And I think that can be comforting for a lot of people because there aren't a lot of answers right now. So sometimes leaning in, seeing a beginning, a middle, and an end, and then on the next episode, there's a whole new problem. That can be very comforting.
So, Rafer, even though you're not a huge fan of the dystopian movies for this moment, do you have any recommendations? Maybe dystopian films that have a sense of optimism?
Yeah, not too many do. You know, one movie that I always find myself going back to these days is the old John Carpenter movie, Escape from New York, where New York has become the giant prison. And Kurt Russell has to go inside and rescue the downed president and, drag him back out of New York. And all the prisoners are trying to keep him there because they want to hold him hostage. And it's just a great, then as now, it was just a perfect metaphor for Manhattan. And it's a lot of fun. And it's got that great John Carpenter over the top, really vivid feel to it. And it's always been a real favorite of mine. And, and it's not a dystopian movie that, is going to, make you too depressed, not like Handmaiden's Tale or something like that,
Ooh. Yeah. I sometimes need to take a break from some of those kinds of films and TV shows. Yeah,
right.
I've heard from some people that they are rewatching movies that they've watched many, many times before at this moment. And I know that I tend to do this a lot. And I sometimes feel guilty about it because I know there's so many great movies that I haven't seen before that I should probably be watching. Should I feel guilty? Have you heard this from other people?
Oh, yes. We've heard it from a lot of people. And there are actually some studies that indicate that it is a good thing to do to help ease anxiety, to watch a movie or a TV show where we already know what this character is going to say next, and we already know what's going to happen in this scene and the scene after, and we know there's going to be a happy ending, because there aren't going to be any surprises. There aren't going to be any things that, throw us off kilter, because all of it is predictable. All of it's comforting. Even the scary parts are comforting because we know they're coming. And I think that's totally fine. I've been doing the same thing. I've been watching an episode of Little House on the Prairie at least 3 times a week since this has started. It was a show that I just absolutely adored growing up. It was in syndication after school every day for many, many, many years in Minnesota. And it was such a huge part of my life. And yes, I think I know every episode by heart, but it still makes me feel good just to sit down and watch something I know by heart right now.
Rafer, what's something that you like to watch that just makes you feel at ease and comforted?
Well, I think having two kids, both boys, 9 and 12, my poor wife, surrounded by men in the house. But, we're big action guys. And so, this has been a lot of fun to go back and watch all the old great Harrison Ford action films, which they've just loved. The Fugitive, we saw Air Force One. And, they're really corny. They're really well-made, though, too, and a lot of fun. They still really hold up as entertainment. My older kid, I guess you would think, being the son of a movie critic, he would be a little different, but he always says, "I don't like dramas. I just want comedy, action, or action comedy."
Uh-huh.
So, these movies have
to
been...
Move.
Exactly. I don't think he wants to dwell on feelings a lot. And so these have been perfect, and they're fun. And who doesn't love Harrison Ford? So next up might be Witness. We're trying to decide whether the kids can handle that one. So these old kind of 80s, 90s action films, I find they're pretty fun, and they're new to my kids. So they fit the bill.
Do you have any recommendations for people who are thinking that this is a great time to bone up on their classics, on the Criterion Collection, or anything that they feel like, wow, that's in the canon. I need to watch that.
I would say It really depends on what kind of household you're in. You know, if you don't have kids, then, you know, maybe you're free to go through that. I don't have the luxury of that. I did put on not too long ago, Le Vampire. It's the French silent serial about the kind of the cat burglars that crawl in and out of people's houses. It's this, you know, very influential French series, silent film. Not a lot of people are going to watch that. I really enjoyed that. But, you know, let's be honest, if I'm watching that starting at about 9:30 p.m., there's just only so much of that I'm going to be able to stay awake for. You know, even me, Mr. Film Critic, you know, I'm not going to be able to stay up until 11 or 12 p.m. watching old silent films. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I would kind of say that people should maybe give themselves a bit of a break on that and not try to bite off too much. And, you know, I don't know if you want to sit through, you know, Berlin Alexanderplatz at this point in time. I really advise going for the feel good stuff.
Kristen, what are your thoughts on classics?
Well, if you're going to do classics, I am going to vote that you go in for some fun ones for the same reason that Rafer said, like, you know, a lot of the classics during this time might put you to sleep. They might be too much to concentrate on. And I'm also a big believer that during this time, you don't have to live your best pandemic. You don't have to walk out of this having accomplished a lot. If you don't want to, that's fine. You can just relax. But if you are going to dip your toes into something like the Criterion Collection, maybe start with something fun. Like one movie that I like quite a bit that's on the Criterion Collection is Destry Rides Again, in which Jimmy Stewart and Marlena Dietrich, he is a man who's essentially the sheriff of the small Western town, and he doesn't use guns. Marlena mm-hmm. Dietrich is a very smart talking saloon gal. They, you know, overcome bad guys. They get up to no good. There are lots of laughs in it. So maybe if you're going to get into the Criterion Collection, maybe start with those kinds of movies where you can laugh and maybe learn a little bit of something about, you know, who were these big stars were back then. You know, if you've never seen a Marlena Dietrich movie, if you've never seen a Jimmy Stewart movie, maybe this is a good place to start.
I wonder if you two are coming up with little sort of projects for people, or if anyone's asked to be assigned or given a whole list of movies to watch. Like the other day, my husband and I decided, because we really enjoyed watching Parasite, the Bong Joon-ho film.
Such a good movie. Yep.
Best film last year, and he won Best Director. And so we decided to go back and start watching some other Bong Joon-ho films, and we really enjoyed it. We watched Okja, which was fantastic and really enjoyable. And then we watched his film Snowpiercer, which is about people who are the last remaining people on Earth who are all on this one train together. And for me, that was really intense. And maybe it's the intensity of being locked in my house or something that it just kind of messed with my mind. Are you coming up with any sets or sort of projects for people to take on?
Yes, I've absolutely recommended larger watching projects. For example, we have had parents write in saying, I'm just so overwhelmed with the kids being at home at all hours while I'm trying to still work a full-time job, and I'm supposed to somehow be a teacher right now when I am not a good teacher, and I need a break from my kids. And in those cases, I'll sometimes give them a long list of TV shows that you can have your kids watch guilt-free. You don't have to feel bad about your kid watching, 20 hours a week of Mr. Rogers, Sesame Street, and then Dolly Parton reading bedtime stories to you, for example. So sometimes I'll come up with a bigger prescription like that.
That is a guilt-less playlist right there. I wonder if you could both leave us with one last recommendation. Maybe a great new-ish movie, a movie that's come out in the past couple of years that you love recommending to people?
One that we recommended to a listener a while back, somebody who was really missing New York and just sort of the feel of walking around the neighborhood. We recommended Top Five, the Chris Rock movie, where he's just sort of plays a version of himself. He's with Rosario Dawson, who plays a journalist. And they just kind of spend sort of a day and a night walking around New York and, you know, kind of meeting people and talking and meeting his friends and family. And it's just this really fun, lively kind of love letter to New York. I know that's kind of a cliche, but it really is. And it's not a long ago film, so it really does kind of capture the New York that you remember. Mm-hmm. And it's very funny and fun. And we recommended that one, and I thought that was a good pick on our part.
Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer is a culture critic and the author of the book How to Be Fine. And together, they are the hosts of the podcast Movie Therapy. Thank you to both of you for coming back on The Takeaway.
Thank you.
That's all for today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Shamita Basu. This is The Takeaway. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.